Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sam Legasek.
And I'm Dreadful Dan Gallagher. And we're two old buddies that have lived our life at the edge of the mainstream.
So come join us where things are a little odd.
This is the...
This earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oddcast Movies, Music and Gaming. Here with me on this spooky episode of Oddcast. Is Dreadful Dan G.
Hello, everyone. It is I, indeed, Dreadful Dan G. How are you doing, Sam?
Yeah, good. This is your favourite time of year, isn't it?
Oh, I love it. Absolutely love it. What's your favourite film to actually watch on Halloween?
You know what? And this is no joke of a lie. It is actually Santa Claus. The movie.
You little tinker.
I'm kidding. The actual film that I do love to watch on Halloween or around the Halloween time is, in fact, today's subject.
Oh, how convenient.
Which is John Carpenter's Halloween. Let's have a little listen of the trailer, the spooky trailer.
Halloween night, a small American town, 15 years ago. Michael?
I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another...
Yeah, so that kind of gives you an indication. I love that little... Da-da-da.
I enjoyed the little Donald Pleasance dialogue.
Oh, that's great. This has to be the only Halloween film where he isn't absolutely insane. So, Dan, before we get into it, give me a little bit of a background on you and Michael Myers.
I've only seen this film once before.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and I can't remember. I have seen other Halloween films, but it's been spotty and sporadic. I can't even really remember which ones they were. So, this is just the second time I've seen it. It was enjoyable.
Right. Yeah.
I think the first time I watched it, maybe I was a bit more maybe involved. Whereas this time I was a little bit more just kind of like looking out, maybe because, you know, I knew we were going to be doing the show. I was kind of just like looking out for kind of more what's going on, what's the mechanics of this film being made. I didn't maybe get as absorbed into it. And I was like, wow, it's actually really simple and straightforward and not really all that much happens. So I was quite impressed, actually. I was like, this is all about, you know, good direction, good use of music. And really, it's about just creating fear rather than telling a story as such, because the story is just like, yeah, super, super basic, isn't it?
Yeah. Dan, I have to be honest, you've pretty much hit the nail on the head, I would say. You pretty much got it exactly right. I mean, I always say, and I'll kind of come on to this a bit later, about how a lot of people... So when we talked about Black Christmas before, 1974 film, previous episode, check it out. I might have mentioned it back then, but basically a lot of people said how Halloween was basically the Black Christmas sequel that never happened, because basically the director and John Carpenter were mates or whatever, and John Carpenter loved Black Christmas and was like, if you were going to do a sequel, what would you do? And he was like, oh, I don't want to do a sequel. Like, I don't want to do horror again. And he was like, what would you do? He was like, I would have someone like escape from a mental asylum and basically like hunt some teenagers down or something like that, whatever. And then he's like, I don't take credit for it or anything. Like it's his own film. But I always think, like, when you compare it to Black Christmas, and the reason why I'm talking about it is that I always think of Black Christmas as a really good film. Yeah. Halloween is a really good experience. Like you are... It's still a good film, but as in, like, you experience Halloween, you kind of watch Black Christmas, another slasher horror movies, whatever. That's what I like to think of it as.
I think I agree with that. I think that sums it up nicely. I did think, I think Black Christmas maybe has a bit more rewatchability. I don't think I could watch Halloween again now, maybe. Definitely be diminishing returns at this point.
Yeah.
But I'm quite interested in some of the sequels now.
Well, there's about another like 12 films or something, especially next that Halloween Kills just came out recently.
Yeah, I
haven't seen yet. So whenever I go back to the original Halloween, and yeah, I usually do watch it kind of every Halloween, and it has next to no effect anymore, if you know what I mean. I just quite like watching it. It's more like a nostalgic kind of warm hug rather than, you know, I'm watching it to get scared or anything like that. And there's certain like moments which I think...
pumpkin enjoy. Spice latte.
Exactly. Yeah, basically. but Halloween 2, so I'm not going to go into all the Halloween sequels, but there's a lot. But Halloween 2, which was 1981, I think it was released in the end, it's a direct sequel, like, as in, like, it picks up straight away from the ending of the first one.
Yeah, Halloween. I have seen that. I remember seeing it vaguely, and I think I saw it before Halloween.
Right, okay.
So, that's great, isn't it?
It doesn't... Yeah, it's not the best way to do it. but it's weird. Like, I watched Halloween 2 again recently, and I was like, okay, this is like a normal... It's not doing anything. Like, this is your bog standard kind of slasher film. And it's not directed by Carpenter, though Carpenter and Deborah Hill did write it, apparently.
Yeah.
And I'm sure made a bit of money off it. I loved the idea of Michael Myers, and I always enjoyed, like, more so than Jason and all this, I always thought Michael Myers had a certain like quiet freakiness to him, which, you know, Jason and the chainsaw, you know, and all this, and you got like Freddy Krueger and whatever, you know, if you go down like the kind of monsters of horror. But I always had like a respect for Michael Myers in the fact that he's just like silently getting on with it. There's no, like, he's completely void of any character, which is part of the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he's just this unknown stalker, right? So... You know, Freddy Krueger increasingly becomes like a almost like a comedy character, firing off these one-liners as that series progresses. I think especially in this film, just having this cold, unknown, faceless killer is chilling, and that's kind of what contributes, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Mainly to that scare factor.
Mm.
But what do you think, and maybe you can answer this at the end, because this to me is the big question about this film, but what raises it above the level of your bog standard slasher?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think for me, kind of what you touched upon and what, you know, we were talking about, it's an experience, which is one thing, but also just the simplicity of it. I really like. I think as well, that kind of first person perspective, like we'd seen that in Black Christmas, for instance, the opening to Black Christmas.
Yeah.
It wasn't a completely unique thing, but it was, you know, at the time. And as well, don't forget, like, there wasn't really anything like this out there. Like, yeah, okay, I'm not going to keep banging on about Black Christmas, just because I love that film. You know, Halloween is Halloween, and then at Christmas time, I watch Black Christmas. That's pretty much that's my holiday sorted. But I think as well, the way it's directed, in a sense of the tone and also the pacing of it, and some of those shots, it's just great, and it just really works on a very visceral level. Like the music, we'll go into that, but that's very minimal. Like everything is just very, you know, just stark. Like everything about it, and I think that is chilling in itself. You know, like a lot of horror movies, they'll have, you know, and also like the dialogue and all this stuff. Like there's not much in there, and you know, like, yeah, the characters aren't 100% fleshed out. Doesn't really matter too much with something like this, because as you said, there's no real story. Like the characters, that they show you enough that it keeps your interest, but you're not there to watch that kind of thing. If that makes sense. And I don't know if that kind of lifts it above. So that's why when people are like, I think it's shit, I'm like, okay, I can see that. But I think, you know, I always think horror is one of like the purest forms of cinema. And this kind of, you know, in its, as I said, in its minimalism as a horror film, makes it kind of its own unique kind of beast. And I don't think they ever really were able to capture that again. And a lot of films have still tried to do that and they can't really do it. I mean, I always think of things like, this is a shit reference, but The Strangers, with that Liv Tyler, randomly, that movie. And that freaked out a lot of people because like you would see them like just in the background or just standing around with like just a shit mask on. And it freaked out a lot of people, but it's because, because there's like nothing, it's like nothing's really happening. There's no like music to indicate something. I mean, you know, you do have a little bit of this with Halloween, but it's
I don't know this film.
Strangers. I mean, it's a very like bog standard, but it did kind of freak a lot of people out. And I remember watching it going like, it's not really doing anything new, but this is kind of touching upon some of the tools that Halloween had and used, where there's no real motive. You don't really know what they're doing. It's, you know, people's houses. They're all just kind of silently doing things. And it's that thing. But also the thing with Halloween is that there's no horror in it. There's not really any blood or anything. It's all just quite psychological, playing into like primal fears almost.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing that struck me, was the, as you mentioned, the pacing. It's all quite, I think, meticulously done and with good restraints used by, well, in the script and in the direction. Because I suppose, well, without delving too deeply into the plot at this point, we get that first kind of kill, which is a kind of in the past sort of flashback, I suppose. Then the next kill we see happens off camera, and we only become aware of it because a body is revealed in the long grass. And then it isn't really until probably about almost 45, 50 minutes into the film that we get the first true kill that we see and experience.
Yeah.
So we've had, and it's only an hour and a half film, so we've had all that time building up the tension, anticipation, anxiety. And yeah, there's no real gore. It's just sort of chilling. And then we get a couple more. So yeah, those kills are deployed very artfully, I suppose.
Yeah, it reminds me of like in comparison, like when we talked about the witch in a previous episode as well. And what it does there, what Halloween's good at doing, is that it starts off with the horror. It starts off with the scariest bit. And then the rest of it, excuse me, you've got that in your head now. So the rest of it, you're kind of starting the film again, almost. But now you have this in the back of your head, and now it's going very slowly. But there's this element of dread and consequence, almost, that you know what the reality of what could happen is, basically, and that's with you. That's something that Halloween uses and the Witch use, and not many films do that, because essentially you're starting on your crescendo.
Yes, yes.
And yeah, and you're just slowly building back up to it again. So shall I give a little bit more background info on this film, Dan? I think you'd be quite interested in
Let's do it.
The surroundings of it. So Halloween, 1978, slasher film, one of the original slashers, if not the original slasher, depending on who you ask. John Carpenter directed it, wrote it, alongside Deborah Hill. And Deborah Hill is kind of like the unsung hero of a lot of John Carpenter stuff. So there were a couple at the time, and you know, she worked on this, she worked on Escape from New York, for instance. And a lot of people say that, you know, and I think John Carpenter himself said that basically her influence was, you know, immense, basically. Like it's even though it's a John Carpenter film and stuff, Deborah Hill is all over it. And, you know, it's that whole thing, like when people say with George Lucas that, like, George Lucas wasn't really the mastermind of Star Wars. It was actually his original wife, the editor, who was able to kind of rein him in and change his ideas and make them better, basically.
They say the same about Goblin 2 as well. Troll 2, sorry.
Troll 2?
Troll 2, why? Yeah. Which was originally called Goblin, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah. What do you mean? What do they say about it? What, the wife?
They say, yeah, the writer and director's wife was actually the main driver of the script.
Oh, okay.
She wanted to write apparently it was an environmental protest film.
Oh, right. Well, you know, I've never seen Troll 2.
Have you really never seen it?
No. I know it's the...
man.
Yeah, they're so bad, it's good kind of man. Royalty.
There's a subject for a future episode. Jesus.
Yeah. Maybe let's... I don't know. Do we need to start with Troll 1?
No. Good. anyway, I digress.
It's fine. So Deborah Hill, just saying, she's an important part of it. It's originally going to be called The Babysitter Murders. And then basically the company changed it to Halloween. It is
good move.
Until Blair Witch Project, it was the most successful independent film of all time.
No, really?
Yeah. It was made, the budget was 300,000. Some people said it's 300 to 350,000 because I think they had to get more money in to pay Donald Pleasance or something. But let's say 300,000, whatever dollars, was the original budget at least. And it grossed over $70 million.
Wow.
With Carpenter himself he got paid 10 grand to do it at the time, but he got 10% of all the royalties. So he made a cool $7 million.
Right
there off this film anyway. So it's a huge success.
I saw something that suggested later on he felt that he hadn't been paid.
Oh, it might have something to do with that. The 10%, maybe.
He had a spat with Dino De Laurentiis.
Right.
Who I think maybe were the producers.
Yeah, I don't know if Dino De Laurentiis was involved with this movie. I'll kind of come to that anyway. Okay. I don't know who did it, but... it was filmed, even though it's kind of set in the Midwest, it's filmed in California, and they had to throw in loads of like fake brown leaves and all this stuff. And in some shots, you can actually see palm trees in the back of the scene, which is quite funny. Pretty obvious as well, once you know what you're looking for. When it was released as well, it was absolutely panned. A lot of people didn't like it. They thought it was stupid and shit and slow and whatever. And, you know, the fact that there was no story, for instance, they were just like, what is this? But there were a few people who stood up and said they really liked it. The main one really being Roger Ebert, who, you know, was kind of famous for hating on horror movies and, you know, slasher movies in the ilk. But he was basically like, yeah, this is good. It's a good film. And then people started to go see it, and it just slowly, it's a bit of a slow burn, just slowly got more and more popular. And it started basically, Carpenter made Assault on Precinct 13, which I think was made for like $100,000. So pretty cheap. And basically, Erwin Yablans and Mustafa Akkad, who were two basically independent film producers, financiers, got Carpenter and were like, yeah, we want to do a film about someone that goes around killing babysitters. And basically they wanted to do a horror film. They knew that, you know, that it was an easy thing to do, could make lots of money. They'd seen The Exorcist. They wanted to do something like that. So Carpenter was like, okay, cool, I'll do it, but I want full creative control. And they were like, yeah, fine. But yeah, he was going to write it, direct it, obviously score it as well. Deborah Hill and him sat down, started writing it, Babysitting Murders. Then Yablans was like, let's do it, Halloween. That's good. And we'll take place on Halloween night. Like, let's not call it The Babysitter Murders. So it's like, okay, whatever. And Carpenter was like, I want to do like an old haunted house kind of film. So there's always kind of mesh of people and ideas and stuff kind of got put into like what this was. I mean, he said since that the idea going forward after it kind of was a success, and the reason why Halloween 3, for instance, has nothing to do with Michael Myers or Donald Pleasance or anything, it's its own like weird story, is because he thought of it as a franchise where every movie would be something happening on Halloween night. So yeah, it wasn't going to be Michael Myers. It was going to be its own little like Twilight Zone thing almost.
Did they decide that when they came to make that third film, or was that the intention from the very beginning?
I don't know.
Yeah. I'm just curious.
It wouldn't have been from the very, like, he would not have gone into Halloween thinking, I'm going to make more of these.
Yeah.
This would have been a one-off once he started. We talk about it, like Bob Clark, as I said, the director of Black Christmas. I've got a little quote from him here, actually. I might as well just read it out. So he said, I did a film about 3 years later, started a film with John Carpenter. It was his first film for Warner Brothers, which picked up Black Christmas. He asked me if I was ever going to do a sequel, and I said no. I was through with horror. I didn't come into the business to do just horror. He said, well, what would you do if you do a sequel? I said, it would be the next year, and the guy would have actually been caught, escape from a mental institution, go back to the house, and they would start all over again. And I'd call it Halloween. The truth is, John didn't copy Black Christmas. He wrote a script, directed the script, did the casting. Halloween is his movie, and besides, the script came to him already titled anyway. He likes Black Christmas and may have been influenced by it, but in no way did John Carpenter copy the idea. 15 other people at that time had thought to do a movie called Halloween, but the script came to John with that title on it. So there's, you know, it's obviously a few facts have got a little bit lost on the way there, but yeah, it didn't come to him called Halloween. He was kind of told to do it. Anyway, so they wrote the script for Halloween in 10 days, very, very short time. Deborah Hill did most of the dialogue between the babysitters and all this stuff. Carpenter kind of focused on more of the pleasant stuff and the Michael Myers bits and pieces, and they kind of, you know, did it like that.
I think that dialogue between the babysitters is really natural.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I think makes the film really work, is that those characters are very relatable and believable. Especially Jamie Lee Curtis, and her performance is really good.
Yeah, well, it's been criticized since for being like an anti-feminist kind of movie, because they're just talking about, basically they all just want to get laid and like get drunk and whatever, and that's all they ever talk about. But then Carpenter since said,
she doesn't want to, though.
Isn't that what teenagers always talk about? Yeah, I mean, she kind of, obviously, that's kind of part of
her. She's more rounded as the kind of central character.
Yeah, she's, she's kind of, but the argument is that she's more sexually frustrated. and all this stuff. But we'll come to that. So yeah, they originally wanted the film to be like a bit like a classic kind of like, you know, jump scare every few minutes or whatever. And they were like, no, we're not going to do that. They were slightly inspired by the idea of this kind of Celtic tradition of Samhain. And basically the idea is that like Samhain is the boogeyman kind of thing. Like, what was it? Halloween was the night where all the souls are let out to wreak havoc on the living. And then there's a story about the most evil kid who ever lived. And when John came up with this fable of a town with a dark secret of someone who once lived there, and now that evil has come back, that's what made Halloween work. And yeah, Samhain is apparently like this invincible kind of epitome of evil. Yeah, it's just quite interesting. A lot of the names and a lot of the streets and all this stuff are kind of harked back to Carpenter and Hill's childhood, for instance. And yeah, the idea, it says here, Carpenter's inspiration for the evil that Michael embodied came from a visit he'd taken during college to a psychiatric institution in Kentucky. Apparently he visited a ward with the psychology classmates where the most serious mentally ill patients were held. That was kind of my reading. And among these patients was an adolescent boy who possessed a blank schizophrenic stare, and apparently it just stuck with him. And that experience of it is, and his description thereof, is the way that Loomis, Donald Pleasance, describes Michael to Sheriff Brackett.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting.
Yeah, I thought all of this is a bit cheesy, though. I thought this was all like...
Oh, I liked it. It's John Carpenter, like, though.
It's a bit schlocky, isn't it? It's like, he is pure evil. There's no redeeming humanity about him whatsoever. It's basically like, he's the devil.
Yeah, and they're like, "Yo, it's Doctor," but as in like, he's like you've seen him as like the authority and whatever, and like, you know, normally you have like the Doctor figure as like a bookish kind of like science, but he is like, he's beyond that. He's like, you know, the fact that he's turning around going like, "This thing isn't human."
Yeah,
I quite like that, because it's basically kind of making it. It's got the science guy kind of believing in something supernatural. Like, he's already been convinced because he's been years through it. And yeah, it's a bit schlocky, but I quite enjoy that whole thing of like, yeah, like, you know, he's like the authority, and even he's like thinking there's something else like going on here, which makes it like a
kill it with fire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the reason why Jamie Lee Curtis is in it was basically because of her mother, Janet Lee. And Carpenter thought it'd be cool to get like a daughter of a scream queen. She was paid $8,000, I believe, to be in the film.
Wow.
Donald Pleasance, he was the kind of star of it. And I think he did like 3 days of shooting and he got paid like $20,000, something like that. And originally
he's in the Hack era of his career, isn't he?
Yeah.
He does a lot of these kind of films around this point.
Yeah, true. He's just getting the money. Originally, Peter Cushing was going to do it, but the salary was too low, which is kind of fair enough.
Was this Michael Jamie Myers, Lee Curtis's first role?
First feature, yeah.
Has she done anything before this at all?
I don't know if she'd done anything at all. This is definitely her first feature, I believe. Okay. And definitely a first starring role. Michael Myers himself, well, in the script, he was just kind of called The Shape. Was mainly played by this guy called Nick Castle, who I kind of come on to a bit later. And they both attended USC, University of Southern California. But yeah, Nick Castle, funny enough, went on to direct The Last Starfighter, if you remember that film.
No.
Dennis the Menace, for instance. Major Payne.
Yeah, Major Payne. That sounds terrible. Yeah,
1995. So he did his own little bit. I mean, The Last Starfighter is probably the most famous of those, maybe. And then a guy called Tony Moran plays the unmasked Michael at the end of the film. And his sister, Erin Moran, was Joni from Happy Days. And if you actually look at their faces, you can kind of see a similarity as well. But at the time he was dressed up in Hollywood as Frankenstein, you know, like you get those people that, you know, stand to get photos taken with all the tourists or whatever.
Yeah.
They're just Yeah, it was quite funny. So,
were you just standing around street corners waiting for people to come up and give him a dollar to take a photo with him?
Yeah, that's what they do, mate, in LA. Have you seen that? That's like Chinese theatre, normally. Yeah. I mean, it's been going on for decades.
Jesus, that's pathetic.
Yeah. That's it. And also the art director, I believe, is also put on the costume every now and then. It was a very low budget, as you said. Everything was bought cheap. A lot of people brought their own clothes. A lot of the cast were helping lug the equipment around and all this. Apparently, Jamie Lee Curtis and John Carpenter had thought up together a kind of fear meter, because it was all filmed out of sequence, just to get a sense of how scared should you be? And all this, which I found quite funny.
Pants shittingly scared in this scene, Jamie.
Yeah, exactly. You were 10 on this one. What I love as well is that when Nick Castle was like, okay, so, you know, what do you want me to do for this bit? He was like, just walk over there. Just walk over there and stand there. You don't have to. I think he specifically said at one point, you just have to not act.
So it's like, it's not a very demanding role, is it?
No, not really. Carpenter did the score himself. He did it in 3 days. He was inspired by Suspiria and Exorcist, as you could probably hear. There are other songs in the film. One of them is actually performed by a band called the Coupe de Villes.
And that was
a band that John Carpenter, the production designer, Tommy Lee Wallace, and Nick Castle were in. It was a band they were in, which is quite funny. Cool. Yeah, it's weird.
What's that song? I can't remember it.
I don't know. I don't think it has a name. It's when one of them gets in the car or whatever. It's kind of on the radio in the background.
Okay.
Unbelievably, it was shot in May and released in October, which to me is insane. Absolutely insane, because obviously it has to be out for Halloween. And it was released October the 25th, I think. And then what I also love as well is in 1980, and this is quite important actually, in 1980 the television rights got sold for, it's like $3 million or something like that. But they had to cut out a whole bunch of scenes so that it could get through. So then they were left with the problem. It's like, well, we need to fill that 2-hour time slot, but you've like cut out like 12 minutes or something like that of the movie. So as they were shooting Halloween 2, Carpenter went out and, using all the sets and stuff, filmed more material to fit into the TV thing. So there's actually additional scenes out there that are in the TV version. There's some scenes, it's mainly around Dr. Loomis in the hospital, obviously, because Halloween, well, it's not obvious, but Halloween 2 is set mostly in a hospital, in the hospital that Jamie Lee Curtis gets sent to after her ordeal. There's like a bit where there's a Dr. Loomis is at like a hospital board review, and he's like, you know, oh, you know, you can't do this or whatever. He's insane. He's evil or whatever. Another one where he's at, he looks at the cell that's been abandoned because, where Michael Myers has left, and there's like the word sister scratched into the door. And then just other little bits to do with some of the babysitters and whatever. So there's actually like a version of the film out there.
That's cool.
Completely, scenes that are redone specifically for the TV version, which I thought was quite strange.
Yeah.
You'll notice as well, they're watching Thing from Another World, which is interesting. We've covered it ourselves on the podcast, but also obviously I don't think it was that great, but obviously Carpenter was a big fan and went on to film The Thing a few years after.
They didn't like it either. They kept like, it's like, watch the film or don't. They watched the intro. Then he's like, can we make the jack-o'-lantern?
Yeah.
And then later on, they're like, oh, we'll watch a bit more of the film.
Yeah, I was thinking, sure, it's finished by now.
Just sit down, shut up and watch the effing film. It's a bloody masterpiece, classic of sci-fi.
Masterpiece, yeah. You might notice someone called PJ Souls. The blonde girl in it, she was in Carrie, but also I always remember as Rock and Roll High School, the Ramones movie. She's basically the main girl in that. A lot of the shots that were done were basically a cheap version of a Steadicam, which is called, I think it's called a Pan Glide, which is quite cool. The mask itself, as people may know, it's a William Shatner mask that was bought for, I think, a dollar or something. And they cut the eyes out and painted it white, just because they wanted it to be completely void of any kind of emotion. That's quite cool. And apparently that kind of came from The Mask itself. It was from that classic film, Eyes Without a Face. I don't know if you've seen that. You've probably seen photos from it, at least, if you haven't seen the film itself.
It's a great film.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And yeah, what I also enjoyed is when you've got those final few scenes. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll kind of come on to that when we go through it. But that's kind of it. That's kind of all the facts and little tidbits of information I've got with it, I think. There are some other bits as well, but I don't think they're particularly interesting. But yeah, I think it's crazy how, you know, he made it on a very, very, you know, crazy short time frame. You know, I can't think of many directors that would agree to something like that. And a low budget, and was able to make something that was, you know, stuck in people's heads for so long and became like a horror masterpiece. That's the magic and beauty of John Carpenter, I think, right there.
Just gave the people what they wanted.
It really, really did. Really, really did. So Dan, should we go into a little bit about the plot, I guess? Why don't you take us through the plot, and then because I feel like I've talked a lot.
All right. Well, yeah, let's go roughly through the film. Because actually, the first thing we get is that fantastic opening kind of, I don't know what you call it, like sequence with the pumpkin, which I just really liked. Just really got me in the mood, you know. You've got the fantastic Carpenter music.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just like black with a pumpkin. And these brilliant, what have become iconic kind of font, I suppose. I don't know what to call it.
Yeah.
Did that exist before this film? Did they just take something off the shelf, so to speak? Or did someone make that for Halloween? Because it's fantastic. It just screams 70s horror now, doesn't it? It's become synonymous, that typography, with this era of horror film.
Yeah,
all of that looks really cool.
Yeah, it does look cool. Yeah,
and then it's like a shot through the eye of the
eye. Yeah, and which also is, you know, which kind of when you go through into the next bit, right, and everything's kind of like a POV. So you're kind of going into the darkness, into the point of view, into the mind of the pumpkin, the Halloween, the scariness of
it. It's like a nice little framing thing of almost like, I invite you in for a tale of horror this Hallow's Eve. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so.
So then, yeah, we got the proper kind of like opening sequence, which is like happened in the past. This felt very Black Christmas.
Yeah.
Specifically, we're following, we are the eyes of an unknown, well, what becomes an assailant. A peeping Tom as well. It's quite, at this point, it's actually a little bit sexually charged.
Yeah.
And you just see this scene in the living room on the sofa playing out, a little bit of hanky-panky going on. And this person enters through the side of the house, goes into the kitchen. You see like a kind of like green satin arm going for a knife. You see this guy leave the house. Then basically you go up the stairs. It's all point of view. You go in, you see a pretty nubile young lady stripped to the waist.
Mm-hmm.
And then stab, stab, stab. Stabbity, stabbity. Blood and death. And then
what's great about the stabbing as well is that he's looking at his hand. Can you imagine if you're like actually killing someone? You're like, what am I doing? You're not looking at them. I'm doing it. Look at this. But yeah, the kind of important thing as well, and one of the things that I always forget, because obviously once you've seen it, you know what's going on, is that you're presuming this is like a man, whatever, like a killer, serial killing man or something like that.
Yeah.
Which makes this, which makes the next bit a bit more powerful, impactful.
Exactly. So, yeah, out the house. And as you're leaving the house via the front door, there's a car pulling up. And this just happens in a split second, but I was kind of like, oh, that's quite exciting. What's going to happen? It could be the police, or is it an accomplice and he's going to jump in the car? But no, it's just a couple, and you realise, okay, the parents of this girl that's been murdered. But they just look curious. So you're like, okay, they must know this person. Mm. And then, yeah, you get that shot where it pulls back and there's just the boy dressed as a harlequin or a clown standing on the lawn with the bloody kitchen knife. Mm. And each parent either side of him just kind of looking...
And what's happening, Michael?
Quizzical. Whatever. Mm. They're not even horrified. They're just like confused.
Yeah.
What is this?
It's nice. So yeah, that's the big reveal. That was actually, you know, it's this little boy. And he was wearing a mask as well, which obviously plays into later because that was like, that's his like costume as such. And he tries to do something similar, you know, afterwards in the rest of the film. You know, he's got that blank expression, but it is like it's a classic kind of thing about, as you said, it's like sexually charged, basically. He's like, you know, sister's like topless or whatever. He's seen her with whatever. There's a, you know, and there's some kind of like perverse kind of idea of like, you know, incestuous fantasy or something kind of probably going on there, even at that.
Yeah. Like, is it jealousy or is it like he's punishing her for her sexuality and his is
exactly
repressed or hasn't even developed yet? Or yeah.
Yeah. And it might be that it's like no one's looking after him, but she's, you know, but she's off gallivanting and having sex or whatever. And then he's appropriating that kind of, I don't know, maybe it's like a hatred of women or something. Something suddenly grown out of this because he just sees them as these like, you know, sexually charged, like, you know, irresponsible objects, which is exactly like, and this is what I was talking about earlier, like the babysitter's talking about sex. They're all like, we're going to go get laid. We're going to like, you know, have you spoken to Bobby or whatever, blah, 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 and all this. Anyway.
This sets the groundwork, right, for that cliche then, for every slasher of like the ones that have sex get killed first, right?
Yes, exactly. But, keeps that tradition going.
It's hard to know what the intention is here, but I suppose it just does enough that you can read all of these different things into it.
It's just creepy. To the motivation. It's a creepy kid.
Yeah.
Creepy kid, killed his sister. You didn't expect it to be a kid. And now we cut to however many years it is in the future, like 10 years or something, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that.
But yeah, I can't remember.
I thought about this because later Donald Pleasance, right? He's like, the boy was 6 and I worked with him 15 years ago. So I'm like, okay, he's 21. But when the credits roll, it says Michael, age 23, played by so-and-so.
So, well, who knows?
Anyway, yeah. I can't quite remember what the first scene is. Is it with Jamie Lee Curtis or is it with Donald and his aide?
It's with... Are you trying to say you're not prepared for this? It's with Donald Pleasance and he's with the nurse in the car. And she's like, oh, we got to move him or something. And he's just like warning her, like, you know, he's not like a normal patient. And she's like, all right, chill out, like whatever.
It's just already, over-egging it a bit, I think. He's not a man. She says, do you have to call him it? And he's like,
yeah, that's right, yeah.
It's not a man. I don't know. Yeah, this is all a bit silly. I thought everything about Donald Pleasance's character is a bit silly and a bit overblown, but yeah, I suppose that's part of the appeal. What happens here, right? Because you've got all this, and he should never get out. And she's like, well, why are you moving him then? It's like, oh, it's the law. And then of course, you know, 2 minutes later, like they've had to stop to open a gate or something. And he just manages to get out the car and he's on the roof. Bashing about like a busy monkey.
Something's happened, but it's not like it's never said like whether it's a case of like Michael did it or whether it's just something happened, but basically all the mentalists are let loose for some reason, which we never really gather why. And yeah, I think the reason why they're moving him, he kind of talks about it at some point. I don't know if it's in Halloween 2 or not, but a bit later on where it's like, he's the perfect kind of, he's the perfect patient because he doesn't do anything. He just sits there, takes his meds or whatever. Like he's very, very quiet, imagine quite timid or whatever. And just kind of gets on with it. So I think the idea is that he's being moved and like he's against it. He's like, no, you don't understand. This guy's insane and a killer or whatever. But in theory, he's been like a good prisoner.
Well, he alludes to the fact that he thinks he's biding his time.
Yes, yes.
So it's exactly. Kind of like he sits there, does nothing, stares beyond the wall, doesn't even seem to see it, but he's waiting for his opportunity.
Yeah, and his opportunity has, I mean, it'd be coincidental if he didn't have anything to do with it, because the whole point is that it's like his sister, he killed his sister on Halloween night and he was in, you know, so it'd be much a coincidence if it's like he had nothing to do with it. But just because of the way he moves through the rest of the film, you'd like to think that he's got something, he's managed to somehow make something happen for him to be able to escape.
Yeah, he's got a plan. It's not opportunistic.
Yeah, exactly.
How does he get out of this car? Because you see the car, the boot isn't open or anything. Are you suggesting that there's some kind of supernatural manipulation occurring here?
Well, in the car, he just jumps on top of the car, smashes the window, and she gets out and he just gets in.
Yeah, but how did he... Where was he? Presumably he was locked in the back of the car.
No, he wasn't. No, they're going to pick him up. He's not in the car at this point.
Oh, I thought he was in the car.
No.
So he's just roaming around and he manages to intercept their car.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is that you think he's like planned for it, so he's trying to get hold of a car. I mean, I've always thought of it as he's not in the car. Like, he's not just sitting in the back there. They're like, okay, we've got to go pick him up and take him to another hospital.
I thought he was in the
boot. That's why they turn. No.
Like,
otherwise, there'd be a bit weird. They're turning up to the hospital that they're taking him to, and everyone's been released. No, he's not. They're going to the hospital where he is being kept to pick him up.
That explains a lot.
And he breaks into the car. Yeah, he's not just sitting there whilst they're talking about him. Yeah, in the boot.
Donald Pleasance, some like nasty about him. I thought maybe they just like bound him up and chucked him in the boot.
Is it the law to keep him in the boot?
That animal.
No, but we're not listening to it now. We're not listening to the law this bit.
At this point, then, I did think his arm looked a bit weedy.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Okay. I mean, he has. That's fair enough.
It seems like an inconsequential thing, but later in the film, he does exhibit some incredible strength. He's not a massive bloke, is he? He's not like
no, but that's the thing. He's supposed to be like inhuman. He's a supernatural, strange being who's incapable of dying. By the looks of it, as we kind of get into it. Anyway, let's crack on through the rest of the movie. What happens next?
Well, I think we introduce then Jamie Lee Curtis's character and the little boy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all a bit of a blur for me, but basically it's just setting up. We have some stock nice characters, nice teenagers.
Yep, nice
little boy who's a little bit afraid, a little bit picked on and bullied. Michael Myers is kind of hanging around in this town.
Yeah.
And sort of seems to form a bit of a connection with these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear if like he's targeting them or if he's just like, if it is opportunistic, but like he turns up at the little boy's school. He's just kind of like watching him and
He's kind of creeping about. I think what instigates it a little bit is, I believe like the first thing that, she does, what's her name? Laurie is, she has a dad's like an estate agent or whatever, and she has a key. And she drops it off at the Myers house or something, and they talk about, oh, you know, someone's going to go see the house or whatever. They have a little chat about it, and obviously that's the Myers house where he killed everyone. And I think that's the first time that Michael notices her, and he seems to. And I think the fact that he's seen Laurie at the place where he killed his sister, and it's probably the same age as his sister was back then. I mean, I think, and I'm kind of reading into this, that he's made like some, he's made a connection basically. Young female at the place where he killed his sister.
Yeah.
She is now the replacement thereof. And so he kind of starts mentally stalking her. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like she's just now the main focus of his attention a little bit.
Yeah. And then her mate around this time was banging on about some amazing party that's going to happen. Blah, blah, blah.
Right, yeah.
It's Halloween. Spooky stuff's going on. People are getting ready, pumped up. And then little things are happening that are obviously, we're aware it's Michael, but the townsfolk are just blaming it on the kids.
Like a hardware store or something getting broken into.
Yeah, a hardware store's broken into. And they're like, the policeman's like, well, who else would do it? A couple of knives, a rubber mask, and some rope or something. It's obviously kids getting ready for Halloween. And a grave is dug up, and they even blame that on teenagers. These pesky teenagers.
Yeah.
They love this spooky shit at Halloween. Can't they have any respect?
Yeah. The reason why is because Loomis, Donald Pleasance, is like, he spends most of the film like staking out the Myers place, but he's just trying to like, he's trying to find Michael, and he thinks that, you know, he would have come back to this town. And then he's like, oh, maybe he'll visit the grave of his sister. So that's when you find out they go, and it's like, whose grave was this? And it's like, oh, it was Judith Myers or something.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, Michael's here, whatever. Like he's taken the gravestone. There's a reason.
He takes the gravestone, man. I mean, that's a quite
heavy thing.
Yeah. No one saw that.
Yeah, no one notices this.
Wandering down the street with a big gravestone.
Yeah, exactly.
And possibly with a Captain Kirk mask on.
There's a little bit as well where there's a bit where like Annie is talking, like, you know, the bit where he's behind the bush and he just kind of disappears. She's like, there's no one there. Then you see like some smoke go across the front of the camera, and that's John Carpenter. And that's because John Carpenter's a heavy smoker, and he's just standing too near the too near the camera. There's just this like wisp of smoke that just travels across the frame. This is pretty obvious as well.
Oh man, I didn't see that. I have to go back and watch that.
Yeah, it's quite funny
because this is when it's starting. I think the film's starting to work. It is starting to heighten a bit of tension now.
Yeah,
because he is kind of like.
Creeping around. Yeah, and it's like, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, he's like, he appears, he disappears, you know, he's gone in one shot, he's there in another, and it's all like a little bit like magic or something. So again, it's adding to this like supernatural kind of evil feel.
And the thing that makes it work, this, because this could all be quite silly and campy, but it's that music. Like, that is really anxiety-inducing.
Yeah. You've got that. We heard it earlier, where it's like, oh, a mystery. Oh, something mysterious has happened. But yeah, these tiny, it's like three musical cues, basically, throughout the whole thing. It feels like so scarce. But yeah, it works quite nicely.
What's the next major event that occurs?
Basically, I guess that then, yeah, people start dying at this point. So
yeah, we're into Halloween night now, aren't we? Kind of.
Yeah, we're starting to get there. And yeah, kids are starting to die. I think, is it Annie who gets one of the first ones to get killed? She's in the car. And yeah, she's like, what's all this like condensation on the inside of the car? Which I thought was quite cool. And then Michael appears and basically strangles her.
And then slits her throat.
Slits her throat. Okay.
He strangles her for quite a long time, and which is quite cool because you're like, oh, it's taking a long time. She's probably going to get away. She's going to whack him or something.
Yeah.
She's kicking the horn on the car, and you're like, oh, maybe someone will come. So actually, it takes a long time. And then in the end, he has enough of that and he just slits her throat.
Yeah, I had enough of that. Yeah. Done.
But before that, she's kind of like you say, she's kind of set up to be the more the raunchier girl.
Yeah, the raunchier.
She's getting in the car because she's off to pick up her beau, and she's already neglected her babysitting duties by taking I presume it's like her younger sister over to sit with Jamie Lee Curtis.
Laurie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's all quite important. Again, neglecting, as you said, her duty, similar to what Michael went through at the beginning of the film.
So then, like the little boy as well, he keeps going on about the boogeyman, because this is one of the things that the children at school have been like, the boogeyman's going to get you tonight. He's like, what's the boogeyman? And then poor kid, he keeps looking out the window and seeing Michael Myers hanging around. He's like, the boogeyman's here. She's like, there's no boogeyman. Right. Stop being ridiculous or you'll be sent to bed.
Yeah. Idiot. Yeah.
But this is horrible because he looks out the window. And so, of course, the house is across the street. And he actually sees Michael Myers at this point walk round the house carrying that dead body in his arms.
Yeah.
And just like slowly and methodically just like go through the front door.
Yeah. I love that. Everything to do with, that's what's funny is that people think of Laurie's house or whatever. Well, it's not actually Laurie's house, whatever the house that she's in. Maybe it's Laurie's house, whatever. But, and then you've got Michael Myers' house, which doesn't really see any action. And there's one bit where they go in and I don't know if it's happened yet. They find a dog and they're like, oh, the dog's dead. It looks like someone's been eating it. And he's like, he must have been hungry. And I was like, they've made it. It's just, I don't know, that bit always stuck with me because I was like, it's just weird that he's like, they've made it that he's got hungry and eaten a dog. Like, he's so like animalistic. You know what I mean? Like, as in, he would just eat a raw dog. It's like, I didn't really need that bit, but you know, fine. But it's actually the Wallace house. Yeah, exactly. But it's actually that house. I think it's the Wallace house because, I'm reading it here. I'm pretty sure it's the Wallace house where most of this bad stuff happens. And it's actually the creepiest house of the lot.
Yeah.
In my opinion. Because that's where basically everyone dies. So yeah, you've got, he's carrying her inside that house.
Yeah, and he sees that, and so that's horrible. And it's one of those things where you're like, most kind of, I suppose, horror films or any film with like killing or killers, usually that goes unnoticed.
Yeah,
and you've kind of got a sense that, oh, if people saw or knew, then it would all be resolved happily. So there's something, I don't know, there's something chilling about him just like absolutely brazenly walking around the house in clear view of anyone who cares to notice, carrying that dead body.
Yeah,
and you're like, still,
that's the beauty of it. Like, it's Halloween, he's allowed to wear a mask.
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of undercover almost, and whether that's on purpose because he's super smart or not or whatever, you don't know. But yeah, that brazenness, like, you're right, is scary in itself. Just doesn't give a shit.
So then the next big thing is probably two of her friends turn up.
Yeah, that's my favorite, one of my favorite bits.
Which is weird, right? I didn't quite understand what's going on here. Was she meant to be having a party? Why had she invited her friends around?
This is where it all gets a little bit loose for me. I stopped paying attention to the story by this point, but I think they come around and they're like, you know, they're going to have like a little gathering, basically. And then it's like, oh, we're here. I think she calls Jamie Lee Curtis and is like, oh, where's Annie or whatever? No, I don't know. I thought she was there. Oh, maybe they've all gone out. She was going to go pick up Paul or something. It's like, cool, we got the house to ourselves. Yeah. And so they go up there to basically like have sex. And then, this is when poor old Bob, goes downstairs to get beer and basically gets killed. And then there's this brilliant bit where, I love this bit so much, where the door open, like the girl is laying there in bed smoking a cigarette. Or whatever, and then the door just slowly opens, and it's like a ghost sheet with some like glasses,
sunglasses. Over the top. I think they're his spectacles, aren't they?
Yeah, they're his glasses.
Oh man!
And she's like, "Oh, stop being a fool," whatever. But she's like getting creeped out because he's just kind of sitting there, not saying anything. And I remember the first time I ever watched it. I remember thinking, "It's his corpse," like as in like somehow he's just like stood his corpse up. Do you know what I mean? Or something like that.
Yeah.
And then when it started moving, I was like, so it's him, right? Like, it's got to be him. And I remember it never really sat right with me, the idea that he's decided to, like, put a sheet over his head.
Yeah.
Put the glasses on over the sheet, which is also over his mask, and then play this prank. I mean, I know, like, in theory, it's like, oh, I'm going to do it so I can get close to her and also probably... you know, have some fun with it or whatever. But this bit was always very strange.
It's just slightly comical, isn't it? It's a little too comical.
Yeah.
But a memorable scene. And what's scary about it, though, is like she feels like just so vulnerable because she's basically like naked in bed, right?
Yeah.
So that's quite scary.
And then also, like, because she calls Jamie Lee Curtis, and she's getting strangled at the same time. But she thinks her friend has called her just to like make her listen to her have sex.
Yeah, because she's basically going
whatever. Yeah, and Jamie Lee Curtis like, oh God, like, what's wrong with these people? Kind of thing, which I thought was quite funny. And I think there's supposed to be that kind of weird comic edge to it.
But this is when she realizes what's going on, right? Because then she's like, something's not right. She looks over there and like the lights go on and then go off again. And she tries to call back and there's no answer.
Yeah.
So her suspicions are aroused and you're like, maybe ring the police or something. But she doesn't. She goes over to the house and you're like, no, don't do that.
But this is great. This is a perfect bit of directing in my eyes because it's like very slow walk. And you've got this very powerful shot, like looking up at the house as she's getting closer to it. It's completely dark and blacked out. And it's that kind of feeling that you get when you're walking around at night and you're looking at like a dark, empty house that's maybe like a little bit creepy.
Yeah.
And as you're looking at it, like as the audience, you are going through what has just happened there inside. You're thinking, what's maybe happened to the bodies? Where might Michael be? And all the kind of disgusting, horrible stuff that's already just happened in there. And you're getting closer and closer to it and you're watching her. And they really like play up that tension. But they're also just like, it's like when I think of, who's that famous artist who did Nightbirds, whatever it's called.
The Nightbirds.
Yeah. It's the cafe on the corner. There's like three people.
Oh, I do know what you mean, but I don't know who did it.
Oh, God, what's his name? He's like my favourite artist, and I can't remember his name. It's awful. So people could be shouting it.
Ralph Harris? Your favourite artist?
No, he is definitely, unfortunately.
You've got loads of Rolf originals hanging in your in your house.
No. Everybody say no. No way.
I've seen you. You sit on your sofa with your stylophone. Playing a little Rolf Harris stylophone, playing Time of Kangaroo Down Sport, and just looking at your beautiful Rolf Harris paintings.
No, it's not happening. Anyway, his whole thing. Nighthawks, Edward Hopper, thank you. His whole thing was like, you know, painting like empty windows, empty buildings and things like that, whatever. And that's what I always liked about it, because it's always like making you use your imagination for what's kind of going on behind there. And so it reminds me of that. It's basically where I'm going to. It's the idea, you've got these windows, you kind of know what's happening behind them. It's pretty cool. It's a good shot. But yeah, she goes over. It's a very long-winded way to say that I enjoyed that moment.
Yeah, and this is almost exactly what you said when we spoke about Black Christmas.
Yes.
These long lingering shots of just hallways and stairs, all empty void spaces.
It's perfect. I love it. I love it so much. So she goes in. Sorry.
This is the big reveal. This is one of the biggest scare shock moments of the film, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nice kind of sick tableau. Her friend laid out dead on the bed with that headstone of his murdered sister sitting above her.
Mm.
And we just stay with that shot for a little while, let it sink in, which is nice.
Mm. Yeah, well, you wonder like what it means. It feels like it's gone from like he's just killing people to like, oh, there's something more disturbing. He's recreating. You know, the event, basically. It makes it a little bit more, it gives it that, almost reminds you of that personal touch that it's, there's almost a method to the madness, which makes it a little bit scarier in a way.
Yeah. Then things go a little bit Scooby-Doo, because she goes, ah!
Yeah.
Takes a step backward, and that bloke's like dead body, kind of like falls down, hanging upside down. And then she's and then it's like, fall back, and like a door opens, and the other girl, the blonde girl, is like dead in there. What?
Yeah, crossed eyes. Yeah, I never enjoyed that bit. I was always like, I mean, I kind of know why they did it, but I was always like, yeah, it's like a haunted house. It's like going on a ride. Yeah. Something like that. These things just falling out at you. But yeah, and then Myers turns up, and then for someone who's like a killer, he's right in front of her and somehow misses and slashes her arm.
Yeah.
And I always remember thinking, that's really annoying.
Yeah, that is, it made my eyes roll a bit. But I did like how they revealed him. It was quite subtle. I really didn't notice for the first like second of that shot. He's just there in the darkness behind her.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
And then, he bungles it.
Yeah, maybe on purpose, who knows?
Oh. Oh, really?
Well, maybe. But then,
this playing is with a mouse.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. Maybe he doesn't want to kill her, really. He enjoys the pursuit, whatever. But and this bit's cool because now you're into the horror territory, the classic slasher.
Yeah.
You're just trying to get away. And it's again this cool bit where she's like, goes back to the house that she was just in.
Oh.
And you're seeing Michael get closer and closer, just casually walking, getting really fucking close. And you're waiting for this kid to like open the door, and he's like yawning and rubbing his eyes. You're like, hurry up.
Well, before that, what's really horrible is you're like, and this made me think of like Texas Chainsaw Massacre a bit, because it's like the immediate fear is she's in the house with the killer, but she gets out of the house and you're like, oh my God, thank God she's safe. But then it's like that thing, oh my God, she's not safe just because she's got out of the house.
Yeah.
And she's screaming and no one's coming to help her. And she runs to the house next door and she's like, help me. And they literally close the blinds and turn the light off.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And that, like, my heart sank, you know, because that's just, like, all hope being drained out of the audience. It's a really, I thought that was really nice, and it was quite sickening, actually.
Yeah, it's good.
That
yeah,
moment where you're like, there's no help for her here. Even though she's escaped from the house from the killer, actually, that's the moment you realise, basically, his realm is actually, it extends beyond that house, he can get her. And then you're like, yeah, you're like, but if she gets to her house, she'll be safe. And like you say, then it's like, I can't get the key in the door. And she's shouting at the little boy, come down. And he's like, I'm sleepy.
Yeah, exactly. Best.
But eventually, yeah, he opens the door just in the nick of time. And Michael's just slowly progressing. And then this is... She gets in and like locks the door, and then she looks over and the window's open. What was the bloody window doing open? I mean, really, what was it doing? You know, it's the 31st of October. You shouldn't need your sash windows open.
Yeah, it's going to be freezing. Yeah. But yeah, I quite like this bit where it's like, okay, you know, shut out, and they're like sitting there like, you're like, okay, cool. You know, we're going to be safe. And then he's just like, he like poke his head up or something like that. It's like, hello. and then he becomes, they run upstairs, don't they? And then she's like, oh, just stay in here and shut the door. And she pretends like she opens up the window so it looks as if she's climbed outside, and then she's hiding in the cupboard. And there's that famous shot where he's like poking his head in, and then she stabs him. With a coat hanger, which is good.
Which is impressive.
Oh, wait, hold on. Downstairs, doesn't she stab him downstairs? I can't remember.
In the Ghoulies?
Before she runs upstairs, doesn't she stab him?
Oh, I see.
I can't remember.
Not stab him downstairs, but stab him downstairs.
Yeah, literally.
Oh, I can't remember. There's just a lot of rushing around at this point and protect the kids. Well, obviously, that becomes a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We won't get into too deep into it. But then
my concerns became again, it's like you're worried about her. Now suddenly it's like, oh, I'm worried about these two kids.
Yeah. Exactly. So she manages basically when she stabs him in the eye, and he's like, I love those like noises he has, which is just always like, like totally like not, you know, it doesn't feel like it's him making that noise. It's weird, and I know they've done that on purpose, but it makes it even like slightly creepier, like he's slightly retarded or something like that.
He's just mildly perturbed by it.
Yeah, exactly. And then isn't it like then
well, he drops his knife.
Yeah, that's right. And then
he's poking around in the cupboard trying to get her.
Yeah.
And he fumbles it, drops the knife. And this is great. She grabs it and she's just like, whack. Doesn't hesitate. Because I was thinking, it's that thing where like, just do it, just do it. And then in a lot of films, they're too scared. And, you know, she's just like, wham, have a bit of that up here.
Yeah, exactly.
And he looks to be dead. Conked out flat on his back. And she's like, kids, get out of the house, get down the road and tell Ma Dooley to ring the police.
Yeah.
And it's like, what? You go as well, love. Don't just sit there panting.
Yeah, she's making sure she's keeping an eye on him. She's not keeping close enough eye on him at all.
Yeah, so she neglects to keep an eye on him, because then you see the classic kind of like sit up behind her.
Oh, that's great. Completely silent.
Donald Pleasance, meanwhile, we haven't really talked about Donald Pleasance, what he's been up to, but he's kind of like, he's literally just drifting up and down these streets, kind of looking for a sign of Michael Myers.
Yeah, well, he's staking out the house, and then... He randomly notices the car or something that Michael Myers used to get out. So he's like, oh, he's here somewhere. So I'm going to look around, and then, yeah, and then as you say, he's just kind of walking around, and then the kids are out screaming, and he's like,
there's a good bit where he spooks some kids that are trick-or-treating, not trick-or-treating, but they go to like a creepy house.
Yeah.
And he like hides behind the bush.
It's Michael Myers does.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's why he's there. He's not just standing by a random house.
I thought he was getting into the spirit of the season.
No.
He's just behind the bush and he's like, get away from the house.
Yeah, I love that. And he's got like a smile on his face afterwards, after they run off. He really enjoyed it. Then the cop is like, hello? Sorry. It's funny.
The cop's like, okay, if what you're telling me is true, I'm going to get all my men on this. And Donald Pleasant's like, no, don't do that. Don't understand the logic. He's like, if you do that, you'll have a cop on every street corner. Yes. Why do we have to do this by stealth, Donald?
Maybe he wants him to come out. It's bait.
Yeah. So he's a bit of a strange character, really. And then again, he's kind of, the cop's like, if what you're telling me is true, then damn you for letting it happen, or something. Like, damn you for letting him get away in the first place. And Donald Pleasant's just like, okay.
He says, it's like, I'm trying to, like, you know, I think he says something like, you know, it's not my fault or something like that. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I'm getting it mistaken with Halloween too.
Anyway, like you say, these kids come tearing out the house screaming. And so he's like, aha. So in he goes, and basically he just shoots him, right? Bam, bam, bam.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of bits here. Like, yeah, so annoyingly, Laurie keeps dropping the knife, which is a kind of thing which people complain about always to this day, is that every time she stabs Michael Myers, she drops the knife and runs off, where it's like, just keep the knife with you, for God's sake. Why don't you keep dropping it next to him? There's that. But yeah, they have like a little fight upstairs, and she rips his mask off, and then this is when you see his face, and it's like a young man who's, I think his eye looks a bit deformed, but I'm not sure if that's on purpose.
He's got like a scar kind of here across his cheek and up to his eye, so like his eye's kind of getting pulled down a bit.
Yeah, so it's a little bit like
mildly deformed.
Yeah. But I quite like that, the idea that it's like, yeah, it's like normal, but still not quite normal-ish. And then also, it's like, that is, for me, the quintessential, like, great part of what makes it work, is that it's just a little reminder just at the end here that he's a person. He's still like a human. He's just some kid. Like, you've seen him as this, like, monster, this big, scary, weird monster at the whole thing. And then really, he's just some, like, skinny little kid. Who's just murderous. He just looks like, he's got that kind of like blank-eyed stare still that you heard about. He's just completely like spaced out. And I always enjoy that bit. I thought it was pretty cool. But yeah, basically, she's like, oh, help me. And Donald Pleasance like runs in, and he's just basically standing there like, hey. Then he shoots him 6 times, and which is what Donald Pleasance is always shouting in the next film, at the start of the next film. He's like, I've shot him 6 times. And he kind of falls off the balcony and he lands on the floor, and they're like, oh God, and what is it? Like, Laurie says something like, so there is such a thing as a boogeyman or something. And he's like, I guess there is, or something lame.
Yeah.
And then they all come up and it's like, oh, what's happened? And then they look back and he's gone. And there's dead and 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 dead. And what's great, and this is what I was going to say earlier, is that this end sequence, and again, like we were talking about a bit on Black Christmas, where it's shots of like places that he's been and like the town and things that we've seen and the horrible stuff that's kind of happened, as in, it's just these empty spaces that you're like waiting to be filled, and that he could be anywhere. Like, he's kind of everywhere and nowhere at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of that thing. And apparently they made that decision in the editing room. That wasn't pre-planned. They just they knocked it up. And it's a great ending.
Yeah, good decision. I thought you'd like that.
Loved it.
Again, it made me think of Black Christmas. Mm. It's just like a review of the work that he's done throughout the film, you know, but also a suggestion that he could still be lurking somewhere. And they're very featureless kind of buildings. So it's also like the implication he could be looking at your house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's it. And also, it's a weird little nostalgia trip for you of what's just happened in the last 90 minutes. You said, like, going back through the scenes, but also you're now through these brief, like, 2-3 second shots, you're going through, like, the kind of, you know, 5-10 minute scenes that just happened. And it's almost like your life flashing before your eyes from the last 90 minutes and all the kind of emotions and dread and terror suddenly, like, weirdly, in like this nothing amount of shots, are quickly like coming back to you in a rush. So it's a bit of this, it's a very strange, you know, kind of way to end it in a good positive way. I mean, nothing for me beats the Black Christmas ending, with the phone ringing after all that. I still fucking love that. Oh God, it's so horrible and so great at the same time. That essentially the climax of that film doesn't even happen on screen. It's just perfect. And that's it. That's Halloween in terms of the plot. We won't go into Halloween 2, but Halloween 2 literally picks up straight away. So after we've just seen these empty shots, oh, it could be anywhere. And then Halloween 2 starts with him like basically like trying to get away, finding another knife and getting on. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. So he just kind of ran away. Cool.
So apparently, Sam, Halloween that came out in 2018 is also a direct sequel to this film.
That's right, yeah. So I've seen that. And that basically gets rid of all the sequels. And it's like, so the first film happened and now it's this film 30 years later. Or whatever.
Which is also called Halloween.
Also called Halloween. And I take it you haven't seen it then?
No, I might watch it because I saw a lot of positive comments about it. Should I watch it?
If you want, like, I didn't hate it. I didn't hate it, but it wasn't good.
Okay.
I liked that it kind of had that thing that this film had where he's just kind of like walking around just doing what the fuck he wants. So like, there's some quite nice shots of him just kind of going in and he would just kind of kill someone and work his way through the house and then come out the other side. And all that. And there's those kind of bits where I was like, okay, that's quite cool.
Satisfaction of watching a man take some pride in his industry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. that kind of bold, brazen, you know, murder, which I quite enjoyed. But then like all this stuff with Laurie Strode, whatever, and they try and build a bit more of a character out and she's got a family and then, you know, and they're all like, they all basically gang up on on Michael Myers. And all that. And we should say, like, the kind of the reveal in the second film, which I think was a bit lame and kind of goes against what I was talking about earlier.
Spoiler alert.
Is that they make it that Laurie is actually like the sister that Michael had but never knew about because she was just a baby or whatever when it happened, which the gap would make sense. But I quite like the idea that he's made this kind of connection, as I've said, like between her and what happened, just because she looks like, or is like a young woman, like his sister, rather than there is an actual like family blood connection. But obviously they kind of pursue that more in the additional scenes that they filmed for the TV series, TV release, that is to do with Halloween 2, where they say like, oh yeah, actually she's a sister. I thought that was a bit lame.
Yeah, I was reading, you know, a little bit about the synopses of the next few films, and I saw that, and I thought the same. Oh, that's a bit lame, but I suppose, like we said, there's so kind of little sort of plot or backstory or narrative that if you are going to try and expand this, which I suppose they weren't necessarily trying to do in Halloween 2, but I think by the time you get to 4. They're obviously thinking we're gonna run with this as franchise.
Yeah.
Then I suppose it's just unavoidable to sort of develop a bit more backstory for him and give him more motivation. I was quite interested, or well, I suppose curious as well. Later on, they develop a bit more of something of like a plot around a cult or something. And I thought, oh, that maybe sounds quite fun.
Yeah.
But again, it's taking it into different territory and away from the purity of this first film.
Yeah, I think if I'm right, like Halloween 3 is the one where it's something to do with like TVs and it's nothing to do with Michael Myers. And I think
3's the standalone one.
Yeah, 3 standalone. Halloween 4, it's like Return of the Witch or whatever it's called. Halloween 4 is, I believe, to do with the kids. I think something to do with like Michael Myers. It's Donald Pleasance again and he's looking after some children. Is that 4?
I think 4, he starts stalking Laurie's daughter.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But it turns out that, and again, spoiler, that Laurie's daughter is actually like a murderer as well. There's a scene or something where Michael's left alone with her and they have like a kind of weird connection. And then at the end of that film, she's like a murderer as well. And Donald Pleasance is like, no.
That's the one that I've seen as well. I've definitely seen that.
Yeah, so it's that one. And then I think 5 is to do with the cult. And that Michael Myers is part of some fucking demon cult or something like that. It all gets a bit weird. But should we head on over to like Nerd Corner? Because I think there's a couple of bits that we should probably...
Okay.
Something to talk about. Let's go over there and see what we do. So I was going to kind of talk about the score a little bit, but to be honest, I think it's been done to death and we do love a bit of John Carpenter.
Yeah.
But for me, I thought, why don't we talk about the 1983 Halloween game?
Oh, cool. That sounds good.
Which was for the Atari 2600 by Wizard Video. And it is probably the weirdest, and it's not the weirdest or worst game, but it is pretty dire. So basically you play a babysitter who's trying to save as many children as possible. And this is basically this knife-wielding killer. But each time it comes on screen, it has the Halloween theme tune. So it's all like, you know, like, burp, 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 whatever, you move it through. And it's like, burp, 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 as this like killer comes in. You're like trying to save these little kids. Like, and and basically you're just trying to get these kids away from this killer. And that is it. And that's the whole game. And it's just taking place in different rooms. It is pretty bad. And I'm kind of reading here. To save money, most versions of the game did not even have a label on the cartridge. It was simply a piece of tape with Halloween written in marker.
What the hell?
They say here like the game contained more gore than the film, however, because when the babysitter is killed, her head disappears and is replaced by blood pulsating from the neck as she runs around.
Wow.
And that's basically it. That's the game.
I mean, actually, it sounds great.
You can see it on YouTube, but you can watch 15 seconds of it.
Yeah.
And you will know exactly what happens for the entirety of like the 2-hour game or whatever it is.
My curiosity will be sated. Yeah, maybe it's very fun to just watch a little bit rather than play it.
Yeah, never. I don't think you have to play it, so don't worry. Dan, have you got anything else that you want to discuss about Halloween?
Well, I was going to say about Nerd's Corner that there is a new pressing of the soundtrack. Okay. It's just been released. Funnily enough, the soundtrack didn't come out until 1983. So I suppose it took that long to become, I don't know, I kind of think this time this is like VHS burgeoning kind of market. So maybe, you know, even though it did so well at the box office, maybe it got a little bit more traction and that's when things become like a cult kind of hit, isn't it? When things get picked up on video and people are like watching it over and over and over. So
yeah, and I don't think it, but it's not like an impressive score, if you know what I mean, like when you're watching it, but it does stay in your head. So I imagine it had to take some time to get a bit of a cult following.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of make its like cultural mark on the world for it to be, to warrant a release of such.
But the original release on, I never know how to pronounce this label. They do all the soundtracks. Very Saraband. It's cool, you know, it's kind of like iconic. It's got the poster image on the jacket. I think it looks great. These days, the one that's just come out, so Death Waltz did a release back in January this year. It's got this like image of Michael Myers, a rainy window pane, quite eerie. That was the 40th anniversary edition. But the one that I think is most interesting is Mondo did one back in 2013.
Okay.
Apparently on black, but they randomly inserted orange vinyl into some of them. So if you've got the orange vinyl, there's only one for sale at the moment on Discogs, and they want £800 for it.
Wow.
But it's quite a cool cover. I think you'd like it, Sam, because it's a close-up crop of the Michael Myers mask, although it's a painting of it. But right. the lips are the house.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'll have a look for it.
Yeah, it's quite cool. Like the arch of his lips is like the roof and the tree.
Yeah, I can see it. That is great. That's really good. Yeah, that's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, so some nice and interesting pressings out there.
Yeah, it's funny as well, because if you look at the cover, like with the hand of the knife and the pumpkin and stuff, something that was apparently an accident, but I thought was pretty cool, was in the knuckles, you can see a screaming face.
What?
Yeah, and people are like, is that on purpose or not? But yeah.
I can't see it. In the knuckles, you can see a screaming face?
Yeah, yeah. You can see a face. You can see like two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. Very weird. Apparently, that was an accident, but when it's one of those things, once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
That's mad.
Cool. Well, I think that's it for Halloween. I think we've done that to death now. I don't think there's much else to say about it.
I'm glad I've got that out of the way, because my favourite film to watch on Halloween is Ernest Scared Stupid. So I'll be sitting down and enjoying that.
I've probably seen that, actually. I've randomly seen some Ernest films. Sure, why not? I'm looking at that record as well with the, you're saying, it looks like the disc itself, the pin, the hole in the middle to put it on, is like in the middle of the eye socket. So, you know, it looks pretty scary against white in itself, like, you know, the pupil of his eye almost.
Freakish.
Yeah. Or maybe, yeah. Maybe that's someone's just mocked that up. Anyway, thanks everyone for listening to Halloween, and have a spooky Halloween.
Yeah.
And make sure you don't get killed. Just try that.
Have a good time, but within sensible parameters.
Exactly. Try not to have sex tonight, because you don't know what's going to happen.
Good advice.
One day of the year to not have sex. It's this year. this year. This day. Today. This day.
On Jesus' birthday.
Yeah. Well, Jesus is all about procreation, isn't he? So.
That's Easter. Easter, you can go at it like rabbits.
Feliz Navidad. Easter, you can come again.
Man. Time to end this, I think.
Yeah. All right. Thanks everyone for listening. See ya. Happy Halloween. Bye. Hey guys, thank you for listening to Oddcast Movies, Music and Gaming. If you want to get in touch with us or get a movie, album or game put on our list to discuss, then email us at oddcastoddballs@gmail.com or anewwinterpodcast@gmail.com. This is part of a New Winter Podcast Network, so head on over to anewwinter.net to check out our other shows. You can also follow us on Instagram at anewwinter, Twitter at anewwinter, and you can head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/anewwinter. Thanks for listening, and see you again soon.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.